chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may dab in the middle of it. Grass may dab in the middle. We are grass may dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm Jordan Butler. We've got our first clip here is Tucker Carlson commenting on Joe Rogan's recent interview with Zuckerberg. And Zuckerberg said some things maybe he shouldn't have said about the FBI calling him and so forth. Well, anyway, here we go with Tucker Carlson's take on that.
This is a Fox News alert, and we're not overselling that. This actually is a blockbuster story. So the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, just went on the Joe Rogan podcast. And while speaking to Rogan, he admitted that Facebook censored the New York Post's accurate reporting on Hunter Biden's laptop, which, of course, we all knew. But that Facebook did that because the FBI intervened and told Facebook that laptop was Russian disinformation. And, of course, how would Zuckerberg know? They believe the FBI. Now, keep in mind, the FBI had Hunter Biden's laptop when they said that. They've had it since 2019. So when the FBI told Facebook that on the eve of a presidential election, they knew it was a lie. They interfered in the last presidential election. If ever there was an attack on democracy, it's the country's largest law enforcement agency weighing in a dishonest way 3 weeks before the voting begins. Here's a clip.
There was a lot of attention on Twitter during the election because of the Hunter Biden laptop story, the New York Post.
Yeah, we had that too.
Yeah, so you guys censored that as well?
So we took a different path than Twitter. Basically, the background here is the FBI, I think, basically came to us, some folks on our team, and was like, hey, just so you know, like, you should be on high alert. We thought that there was a lot of Russian propaganda in the 2016 election. We have it on notice that basically there's about to be some kind of dump that's similar to that. So just be vigilant.
So the FBI censored the story. Just to recap, in case you didn't live in this country prior to 2 years ago, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to do that. That is election interference. That is an attack on democracy by our most powerful domestic government agency. It's unbelievable. It defies belief. We actually put in a request to Facebook to see the communications from the FBI to Facebook. We have a right to see it. We hope that they'll send them to us. Keep in mind that in October of 2020, a Facebook executive and Democratic Party operative called Andy Stone claimed that Facebook was blocking the story, quote, as part of our standard process to reduce the spread of misinformation. So they didn't tell us that the FBI had told them it was Russian disinformation. Again, when the FBI knew perfectly well that it wasn't. Harmeet Dhillon has watched all of this from the very beginning. She's the country's premier civil rights lawyer, founder of the Center for American Liberty, joining us tonight. Harmeet, thanks for coming on. This seems like a blockbuster and a shocking story to me.
It is shocking, Tucker, but it confirms information that we already had. So, for example, I already sued Twitter after the election for taking people's speakers down, including my client, Rogan O'Hanley. And it turned out that he was taken down at the request of the California Secretary of State, who was auditioning to become a United States Senator in the Biden administration. And so we filed a lawsuit, went to court, showed the judge all the evidence of how the government was involved in the censorship, and the judge didn't buy it. This case is now pending before the Ninth Circuit, and there have been other instances like this. But hearing it from Mark Zuckerberg's mouth is truly stunning, and I don't know how the government can deny this. So to be clear, the timeline is that just 3 weeks before the 2020 election is when the FBI reached out to Twitter Facebook as well as maybe other companies and said, hey, you know, we heard about this Russian disinformation. You might want to suppress this information on your website. And by the way, when the FBI reaches out to you, taps you on the shoulder and asks you to do something, that isn't a suggestion. They have subpoenas, they have guns, and they also are from a government that regulates you. And so this is shocking, and it demands an investigation, but it just adds up to the pile of evidence that I've been saying points to a major reorganization or disbanding of the FBI is needed at this point. I don't trust anything that they say.
So just to be totally clear, from a legal perspective, the U.S. government is not allowed to use disinformation to encourage censorship for partisan ends. That's not allowed under the Constitution,
right?
Correct?
Tucker, it's a violation of the First Amendment for the government to engage in censorship, quite clearly.
Yeah.
And by the way, who needs Russian disinformation when we have our own? We have our own disinformation coming from the FBI and our own government. And this is not trivial just because it's being done to the other side. Anybody could control the FBI, or some forces can get in there and decide they don't like Joe Biden. Are they going to go out there and start spreading misinformation or suppressing information that's truthful about the Biden administration? I don't like that either. This cannot be allowed. We cannot let our law enforcement do this, and we've seen it before. So this is not the country that we want to be living in, Tucker.
No, it's not. Armitage, thank you so much.
Coming up next is Andy McCarthy interviewed by Jackie DeAngelis. And what's important about this, this occurred just yesterday, and this is after the affidavit was the redacted affidavit on the search of Trump's, Mar-a-Lago was released, heavily redacted. Here's what Andy McCarthy says about, you know, it was out of sync. It was out of character. It's normally not done this way. But here we go with Andy McCarthy and Jackie DeAngelis, quite a fine interviewer.
Joining me now, former Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York and a Fox contributor, Andy McCarthy. Andy, I'm so grateful that we have you tonight to break this down for us. I was listening to your commentary today, your analysis on this. The key to me is what you have said about this affidavit and trying to redact parts of it, keep parts of it sealed. Would give us a little bit of an insight into how close or how far the Justice Department is from potentially bringing charges against former President Trump. In your commentary today, you said your read on this is actually that they may not bring charges at all.
Yeah, well, Jackie, it doesn't make sense to me that they would fight so hard to conceal large portions of an affidavit that in a normal criminal case, what would happen is the affidavit would get turned over to the defense in discovery and it would become a public document. So since that's what would happen if there was a prosecution here, why are they fighting so hard? The other thing is, this is very different from the usual criminal case. In a normal FBI investigation, you do the search warrants when you do the arrests at the end of the investigation. In fact, the arrest warrants and the search warrants are usually supported by the same affidavit statement of probable cause. So it's highly unusual to do a search in the middle of an investigation. It always would run the risk of blowing an investigation if you did things that way, which is another reason why they fought against disclosing it. And the last thing I would just throw out there is, even if you weren't dealing with the one official in the United States who had the authority to declassify whatever he wanted to declassify, classified information prosecutions are very difficult because it's hard to do them without revealing the underlying information. So a lot of these cases collapse of their own weight, not because the people don't deserve to be prosecuted, but because there's too much national security risk to actually doing the case in a public trial.
Right. And you bring up that point, which David just highlighted as well, that classification of SCI is a very high level of classification.
Right.
And that indicates that, what we know in the portions that were unsealed today was that this really was about the documents. There was no smoking gun from what we could see leading towards, towards anything else. And this notion of obstruction, that there was some cooperation. There was back and forth. There were requests for the documents, and that the level of this was raised to a raid status to go into his home and take the documents because the Justice Department felt that he was not being forthright or not handing over what they asked for.
Yeah, I think what they would say, Jackie, is, and I for the life of me, I don't understand why Attorney General Garland made a public statement if he wasn't going to actually address what has people concerned, which is why a warrant and why now? I think what they would say is that they tried many different ways to get this information back. They tried reasoning with the Trump camp. They sent people down to talk to him. They escalated it up to the level of a criminal investigation. They issued grand jury subpoenas not once but twice. They sent the FBI to sort of comb Mar-a-Lago and interview people to make it clear to the Trump camp that they really needed this information back. And they finally probably got down to the point of saying, if we don't go in and take it, what assurance do we have that we'll ever get it back? And the problem with not getting it back is anytime you lose sensitive national security information, this highly classified information, the FBI and the intelligence community have to do a damage assessment to try to figure out how badly compromised are we? Are there informants whose lives might be in danger? Are there intelligence operations where we didn't realize they were blown and maybe like the Chinese or the Russians have been feeding us disinformation? You can imagine, you know, there's a million possibilities that you have to run through, but you can't even really begin to do the job right unless you actually know what you're dealing with, what the documents are.
Okay, final point. The president himself on social media said he feels that this was a witch hunt. Having said that, when you look at the actual raid on his home, going through the personal items, going through closets, clothes, personal effects, they were allowed to do that per the warrant, yes. But some would say they were on some sort of a fishing expedition looking for something else that wasn't necessarily clearly laid out in this warrant. And if they found it, as you have said before, if they felt it was connected to the commission of a crime of some sort, they would be able to take that as well.
That's absolutely right. You know, I think it's not one of these situations, Jackie, where there has to be one single explanation. I think it could be true that they really wanted the classified information back. The National Archives really wanted all the presidential records that by law are supposed to be kept at the National Archives, not at the former president's residence. And if they can hit a home run and find something right, that's relevant to January 6th, they're trying to make a January 6th case. I think all those things simultaneously can be true. They're not mutually exclusive.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Andy, always great to see you. Thank you so much and have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks, Jackie.
Boy, that was quite something, wasn't it? Anyway, this is an interview and a pronouncement about Pelosi. It goes back several years ago, I should say. She said that the president does not have the authority to eliminate debt, that the Congress has to do that. Now she's flip-flopped and said, yeah, Biden could do what he did on reduction of the education debt. So it's in controversy, and it'll be some lawsuits involved, I'm sure. So here we go with that.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi praising President Biden's, quote, historic $300 billion student loan bailout. But just last year, the California lawmaker had a different tune. She was singing a different tune, pointing out that the president doesn't actually have the power to pay off student debt. Watch this.
People think that the president of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone. He can delay. But he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress. I don't even like to call it forgiveness because that implies a transgression. It's not to be forgiven. Just freeing people from those obligations. So that's not even a discussion. Not everybody realizes that, but the president can only postpone, delay, but not forgive.
Well, she might want to call up Joe Biden. Joining the conversation all morning long this morning is Dagan McDowell and Mark Tepper. Dagan, that was pretty significant, what Nancy Pelosi just said there a year ago. And you and I were talking about this just yesterday when the Wall Street Journal came out with that op-ed and said the same thing. The president doesn't have the power. It's Congress's power. So why is he doing it?
Nancy Pelosi's now hedging because, again, this is her party and he's a Democrat. She's saying, we didn't know what authority the president had to do this, and now clearly it seems he has the authority. He doesn't. I would suspect that there will be lawsuits to stop this, but it's actually a great deal worse than even what we show in this graphic, in this chart. Joe Biden is also sweetening the income-based repayment plans that President Barack Obama expanded in the first place. The Wall Street Journal editorial today gets into this. Borrowers currently only pay up to 10% of discretionary income each month, and then after 20 years, you can discharge the debt. But Joe Biden is changing that and lowering it to 5% of discretionary income. And then the government's also going to cover unpaid monthly interest for borrowers so their balances won't balloon. A lot of this kind of doubling in the student debt is that borrowers in recent years weren't paying enough to cover interest and principal payments, so the balances just expanded. So this actually adds, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, just this one thing I'm talking about, to the cost of all of this. But the general message from Joe Biden and his ilk is people who are responsible are a bunch of suckers. And I don't know how voters react to that come November. Because, again, if you didn't take on debt to go to college, if you didn't go to college, you know, 62% of Americans don't have a four-year degree. If you're up, you know, if you paid off your debts, you're a bunch of suckers. That's exactly what Joe Biden has said to you. And are you going to sit back and sit down and take that?
Yep. Yep. I guess I'm a sucker as well. Let me give you the quote from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Mark, and they say, quote, the announcement is gallingly reckless. Reckless because not only does it add to the debt and deficits, it also increases the cost of tuition, likely. And Maya McGinnis, the head of the Committee for a Responsible Budget, says Biden's student debt cancellation will likely cost between $400 and $600 billion. It is not paid for. She says it will add up to twice as much or more to the deficit as was just eliminated from the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. How do you see it?
Well, student loans, no doubt, the availability of student loans have driven tuition rates higher. So that, I mean, you're just going to see more of that happen. I mean, we saw what happened with the EV tax credit, and then I think it was $7,500, and then a day later, the automakers increased the cost of the vehicle by like $8,500 or something like that. You know, Elizabeth Warren made a comment that this in particular was going to help those people living in their parents' basements. If you break America down into income quintiles, the bottom 20% all the way up to the top 20%, the bottom 20%, those people that might be living in their parents' basement, they only get 11% of the benefit. The top 20% get 14.5% of the benefit. This benefits higher paid people more. So she's lying as always.
Yeah, that's a great point. And by the way, whether you're the top 20% or the bottom 20%, you better get ready to get audited. Because there are 87,000 IRS agents about to come for you.
This next clip was a caller to Alex's program. He talked about being working for a plumbing company up in Pennsylvania, West Virginia area. And he says that they've been building large buildings, 500,000 square feet up to a million. He said 2 million in some cases. Square foot buildings. And he said they don't have nearly the plumbing in there to handle large numbers of people, but they were going to use porta potties to expand the capacity if need be. So there's great speculation and mystery about what these buildings are going to be used for. If there's another COVID around that could be worse, are they going to put people in there that have COVID? Are they going to put anti-government people there or anti-climate change people there or whatever. But it seemed to be a mystery about exactly the use that these buildings are going to be placed to. And so if the government's doing it, I don't think it's going to be to our benefit. So here we go with that caller that called in and testified about part building, the part, I think the plumbing part of these buildings.
I work in the construction industry, and we've been building the climate-controlled style buildings, you know, a half million up to 2 million square foot. So that's a major concern. That's why I think
you're saying you're building the admitted new pandemic emergency centers they're building all over the world.
Yes. We have, our company alone has put up about four of them in the past 2 years. Now they're not for lease, they're not for sale, they're just sitting empty, just ready to go. So.
Oh yeah, COVID was the beta test. They're getting ready to release something a lot worse, and that's what's coming next. And here's the deal. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that this thing's collapsing. They're going to want to blame Trump. That's why I've said it's imminent to blame Trump. Now they're officially blaming Trump. And what do they have on Trump if he doesn't stop being pigheaded at this point? Tell us a little bit more, Jeff, about these emergency centers they admit are being built around the planet. They admit they're being built, but where they're being built is secret. Tell us what you're witnessing.
Actually, it's not really secret. They all look like there's giant Amazon buildings. Same color, same everything. Building them close to the interstates, basically taking out all the forest station. I live in an area where it used to be heavily forest. Like, I mean, it was beautiful. Basically, they're displacing all the animals, displacing all the homeless people, which is driving them even farther into the cities and the local suburban areas, and which is causing things to be very dangerous. So it's an all-around issue. Now, these buildings are enormous. They don't have enough facilities to take care of, I guess, the amount of people they're going to put in. But from what we've been hearing is they're going to be putting in a buttload of porta pots. So they do have the ability to bring all those in. And I mean, it's just amazing. If you're standing on one end and you look across to the other side of the building, an F-350 looks like a micro machine, you know.
I want to be clear to new listeners. 2+ years ago, we got the Canadian documents they were building secret facilities. We got it. The mainstream news, Australia, New Zealand, the U.S., they've got all these CDC documents about locking everything down. But now they're admitting it's a climate lockdown that once they turn the power off, they're only going to have these facilities with power and food, training people to go signed up and to basically live in these facilities. And you're saying in the Maryland area, what are you witnessing?
Yeah, I live in Washington County. They call it the Hub City. Basically, there's a distance from West Virginia to Pennsylvania. It's 11 miles across, and they're just putting them up all over the place. And they have enough bathrooms in the facility that will cover the offices in the facility. However, there is no amount of bathrooms for bringing those people in. They have said that they don't know what it is. However, I mean, there's a 2 million square foot facility down outside of Martinsburg, West Virginia. They're putting them all over the place. They don't really say what they're for, unfortunately, and it's scary. They're going all up and down the East Coast. So, and we work for a large HVAC plumbing, you know, contractor, and it's scary knowing what's going on. I tried to put on a lot of people due to the fact of what's going on the past 2.5 years ago, and we've had a lot of people buying your supplies, your products, the storable food. I got books to hand out to everyone. It's overwhelming. One good thing that I like to see is DeSantis is really kicking butt down there. However, we really need to keep him in Florida because I think that we bring Trump up and he, you know, says, "Hey, man, you know, I was lied to." I understand he has a hard time admitting he was wrong because he's been in that mind frame his entire life. But we need DeSantis in Florida. We need a strong governor. We need a strong governor.
I agree with you. We need Trump to come out with the power he has and say, "I wasn't for forced inoculation. I wasn't for going after kids," which he's already been against, and expose these people because they're already saying the shots don't work. They're already saying the masks don't work. They're already blaming him in congressional reports. Trump better get ahead of this. In fact, it's too late for Trump to get ahead of it. He better engage with it. Thank you so much, Jeff. So there's Jeff.
These buildings are being built all over the world. So are there going to be a lockdown, part of the lockdown for resistors or objectors to the government narratives and so forth? That's what we think it is. And that could very well be it. Along with this, they're projecting a new narrative about, it's transhumanistic narrative about God, man, Harari is saying that. And there's other rumblings out there about perfecting man and changing his DNA and so forth. Very dangerous things are in store for us for the future. So we've got to be very, very careful in our readings. And we're at times a useful dupes for these people, okay? And we just fall into their finely, you could say, planned traps, you know what I mean? And, okay, coming up next is a Dr. Paul Cottrell, Harvard professor, that first in February the 29th of 2020, we aired a program and had him quoting his examination of the virus at that time. And he had to say some very powerful things about, well, no, this virus had to be created in a lab. It's not natural, and so forth. But anyway, we're going to put that up and then discuss this COVID thing just a little bit and go from there. Here we go with Dr. Paul Cottrell.
So today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Paul Cottrell. Now, normally when I have a guest on, I like to make a discussion of it, but he has such a large amount of knowledge on the Wuhan coronavirus that I'm going to let him take the floor for most of today's interview. Paul, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I guess we'll start this where it all began. And now you say that the coronavirus did not originate at the Wuhan fish market in December of 2019, like the Chinese and subsequently the world media is reporting. So tell me what seems to make more sense to you.
Okay, we have been trying to use the scientific method. All right, when I say we, I mean my team of little army that's on my channel. But it all started on January 25th. And China released a genome, the Wuhan genome, coronavirus. And I was honestly, I was just going in just for fun to take a look at it. I mean, and like everything, you know, you just step into it and it just grows and grows and grows and you follow the rabbit hole. But I looked at the genome that was published through the NIH. And there is a process called BLAST. And you can search the database and compare other organisms to either protein sequences or RNA sequences, DNA sequences. So that's what I did. I did a BLAST search on the Wuhan strain, just to take a look at it, just for fun. And you can see some, there's some graphical capabilities of the software in the database, some information about what part of the genome codes for what types of proteins and all this stuff. So when I did that BLAST search, it showed about 20 different organisms that are similar, what we call homology. And it gives you a percentage of the similarities and a graphical representation on which nucleotides are similar where within the genome. This particular genome is about 30,000 nucleotides long, depending on the strain you're looking at, but roughly 30,000. It became very clear to me after 5 minutes of looking at the graphics, the graphical representation, that this was not zoonotic. Zoonotic means that it's from nature, that it naturally evolved in nature. I started to create the hypothesis that is it possible that this was a bioengineered virus? And we got to remember that bioengineering happens all the time in labs for scientific study, to understand processes within the cell. In this case, bioengineering really meant supercharging a virus to understand what was going on in the bat host. Why do coronaviruses live in the bat host and how they evolve into SARS or MERS? So there's many different types of viruses. This particular virus is called the coronavirus, but there's many different coronaviruses. Majority of them are very benign. The common cold is one. People that get the common cold, one of the viruses that gives you the common cold is the benign form of corona. But there are also deadly ones, like SARS, MERS, and now this Wuhan strand, or what we call COVID-19. So by looking at the graphical database within the NIH, it became very clear to me on the 25th of January and subsequently on the 27th of January that there was bat SARS-like homology and SARS coronavirus homology in the Wuhan strain. There was about 2,000 nucleotide insertion in the replicase area of the genome. The replicase is what allows the virus to replicate its proteins and its RNA for packaging and leave the cell, the exocytosis of the genome, the farther side of the genome. There is something called the S protein, or the spike protein. This is the protein that actually attaches to the ACE2 receptor. There was a large insertion there, too, over 500 nucleotides. A few days later, there was a paper that was published by three Indian researchers that was published on Cold Spring Harbor's open source database that HIV and HIV gag homology was in the S protein part of the genome for Wuhan, or what we call now COVID-19. If it wasn't for that paper that subsequently was pulled down off the database, if it wasn't for that paper, I would not have been able to go into the actual NIH database and search for that homology, that HIV homology. So what we have with COVID-19 is this. It was bioengineered with that SARS-like virus, SARS virus, and HIV homology. Now, it's possible that the HIV homology was zoonotic. Possible. But I don't think it was, but it's possible. But these other insertions are very improbable that they were zoonotic. That it's much higher probability that they were done by human means in the laboratory. So that's looking at it from the bioinformatic perspective. Then if you look at it from just a pure statistical perspective, the chances in nature for a bat in the same cell to have bat SARS-like virus, SARS virus, and HIV virus, and it just translocates, in a way where it supercharges the replicase and supercharges the S protein, is a very low probability. And then you add it to the fact that, well, that bat bit or was sold at the fish market in Wuhan that happens to be 12 kilometers away from the P4 facility. So you add that as a probability, and so you have to take the probability of something times the probability of another thing times another thing and times another thing, and all these it leads to something like 0.00001% chance that this was zoonotic. So the story, just from a probability standpoint, doesn't seem right. If you look at it from a bioinformatic perspective, it doesn't look right. Then, if you look at the research, what has been published over the years, and we have been able to track down who really broke the news on this particular piece of the puzzle was Lisa Havens. And Lisa Havens had a video on YouTube that stated Dr. Peng Zhao, so P-E-N-G and then Z-H-O-U, and he had a team going all the way back to 2010 that was bioengineering bad SARS-like virus and SARS virus and supercharging it to study why it was able to be hosted in bats. So it wasn't nefarious. Just because we say something is bioengineered doesn't mean that it was done for a bioweapon. Most of this is really, you know, for scientific research to design therapeutics and to design vaccines. But because it's a virulent strand that's bioengineered, it had to be in a P4 or what we call in the United States a BSL4 laboratory. I suspect that there were poor protocols, safety protocols, at the P4 Wuhan facility whereby there was leaks. I don't believe at this moment in time, because there's no evidence, that it was leaked on purpose. But there is, you know, some rumors out there that, you know, that perhaps because it was such a virulent strand for scientific purposes that it could be used as a bioweapon. So people need to understand that what they mean when they say bioweapon. I have this phrase that I try to use as an analogy. You can make a steak knife to cut steak, but you can still kill someone with a steak knife. And that is, I think, what we have here. It could have been used as a bioweapon. I'm not saying it couldn't. I just said that the genesis of this virus was bioengineered for scientific purposes, and it's very, very virulent. So that's kind of like the beginnings of this story. To answer your question on it, I believe it came from the P4 lab through accidental leaks because of poor protocols.
Dr. Cottrell never makes statements about where he can't originally it came from, but Francis Boyle, being interviewed by Alex Jones, is saying that it came out of North Carolina University and it was sold to the Chinese. That's the best idea that the information, in fact, that he has about it. So that's what seems to be, the origin of it, that winding up in Wuhan. And there was a university professor just arrested that had a secret laboratory in Wuhan. And this may be also connected with this virus and the surreptitious of marketing it to China. It's been reported into the billions of dollars. So that could very well have been what was going on. But right now, we have today a upgrade of the condition of the World Health Organization has raised the COVID-19 risk to very high. And we're going to let you listen to that global national clip right now stating that. And that's getting up there. And then we're going to tell you what currently is going on, especially on the West Coast. We've got quite an outbreak that is occurring out there in Oregon and so forth. We've had our first death up in Washington State. So we'll inform you of that. First, we're going to listen to this global national news item announcing the World Health Organization announcing high risk. Here we go now. We're going to finish off the program with Jay Dyer, and he talked about exposing the New World Order on a real deep level. So here we go with Jay Dyer.
And so this is a gradual slow takeover from shadowy elite groups, which are themselves really run by Fortune 100, Fortune 500, the top richest families in the world. They run through entities like the Bank for National Settlements, which is sort of the central bank of central banks. They're connected together with all the biggest private foundations, NGOs, think tanks. They're all working towards the exact same goal that I'm telling you. And all of the books say this. That's why this is so crucial to look at their writings, their white papers, and their techniques and tactics. And what we see in the SPARS document and the Lockstep document is they're always a few steps ahead because they're planning for the failure because they want the existing system to collapse. Now, it may not be overnight. It may not be an economic collapse tomorrow. It may not be a EMP tag tomorrow. It may not be a cyber polygon tomorrow. But we might see staggering versions of these things in the next 10 years, again, getting us to the goals of 2030, 2040, and 2050. Those are key decades, key periods where they want to have certain things complete in their long-term game plan up to 2050. 2050 is slated to be the full-on total AI depop global government. That's the year they've chosen in many, many documents. There might be a little variation, but basically by 2050 is the goal to have the full-on Brave New World technocratic nightmare in, Terminator Skynet system in place. Today I want to talk about the signs that we see that we're actually under siege. You hear Alex talk all the time about siege. What does this mean? Well, this is a type of warfare where you conduct, for example, if someone's holed up in a city, right, you conduct siege to attack their food supply, to attack their water, whatever. We are under siege. And so the best way to understand what's going on is to get out of this model of thinking that it's government ruled by incompetency. We're not ruled by incompetent people. We're ruled by highly competent psychological warfare experts and corporate elite who have a layer of government control out in front of them that takes all the heat. And as I was looking back through the Rockefeller lockstep document, I was reminded of the fact that in the scenario of lockstep, which, by the way, I'm glad Alex hit on that this week because it ties in with this PARS document. Did you notice that what has happened in the last week ties in perfectly with what these documents said would be the next phase of the plan? They said that in the wake of corruption, CDC failure, Fauci failure, et cetera, they don't mention Fauci by name, but they are basically talking about these characters, there would be a public outcry against the failure of the medical system as it is, a public outcry against the politicians, outcry against these officials that botched, failed, mismanaged, and so forth. Now, if you remember back to the events of the Big Nine, right, the Big 9/11 event, we had a lot of people come out that analyzed the event and said, you know, sometimes in the world of intelligence, the biggest failures are the biggest successes. Why would that be? Well, in the wake of big failures, you get the justification for now we need to overhaul the system. Now we need billions more in funding. Now we need mass surveillance everywhere. Now we need to fix all the supposed flaws, which the system actually wanted to be there to begin with. Think back to a few years ago, I think it was the people of the CDC, right? The head of the CDC was saying that it's time to blow up the old system intentionally. So what I'm trying to introduce to you is the idea that the problems, the chaos that occurs in the system is not there by accident. It's not something that was not calculated in the big game plan. It was something that was part of the plan. They said in the SPARS document, for example, which matches up to our years, even though it's listed as in the future. They said that after the outcry against the CDC and these different agencies, the people would clamor for a salvation, clamor for something better because the existing system and its leaders, its politicians, were giant failures. Likewise, lockstep noted that, quote, by 2025, people grew weary of the top-down control and the failures of their leaders. Sporadic pushback became increasingly organized and coordinated. Disaffected youth and people who saw their status of opportunity slip away incited much civil unrest. And then it goes on to give examples of civil unrest. And it talks about how they called for a salvation, somebody to come and save them after the world had basically in some various ways collapsed. In this scenario, and if you don't remember, this scenario was basically the COVID scenario. So this is a 2010 Rockefeller document that said that in the wake of the COVID, what they call the Wuhan virus in the document out of China, face masks, temporary checks at airports and so forth, all of these controls would stay in place, biometric IDs for everyone, getting rid of cars in industry, shutting down travel, airlines, etc. This would lead to, eventually it even says the banning of cars, right, for the purposes of the green agenda. innovation comes to a standstill and a halt. As a result, people cry out against their national government's failures. In the wake of crying out against these inept politicians, these corrupt leaders, corrupt presidents and prime ministers, they cried out and clamored for an international body that would help alleviate the situation, that would solve the problems of the politicians. If you know, in my series, as we've covered the writings of the global elite, we've been through some 50 or 60, 60 if we count the white papers and on top of the big fat books and tomes of the elite have written, we know that they want to bring in a new plan. There's an existing system, the medical system, education system, the internet, the economic system, right? There's these existing systems that they want to move into a new phase and replace. Most people think when they hear this kind of stuff or they're new to this material, they think that it's going to be a top-down tyranny. The government's going to march in and put you into this or that gulag. No, typically, I think in the documents, what we see is not a top-down immediate control. There is heavy-handedness at times. We saw during COVID, especially places like Australia, Mike, we had a lot of top-down control there. And it became a real 1984 hellhole. But that wasn't everywhere, and there was a lot of resistance, obviously. And so as a result, they realized that they would have to gradually bring this in. If you think about the Fabian socialist model, their image is a turtle. And so it's a gradual bringing in of the technocracy so that it goes unnoticed, right? So that it's not overnight. That's a much more effective way of doing this than the heavy-handed, iron-fisted bringing of the top-down control. So I want to go through about 10 signs that we're under siege and that this is actually a plan. Again, I mentioned two documents already that say that the outcry against the failure of public leaders would lead to the cry for an international global government, but which already exists, by the way. It's just kind of in the shadow, but it's now emerging, right? And we see it emerge most clearly through the Great Reset, which is really the World Economic Forum, which is a public version or arm of basically Bilderberg. And so the key takeaway here is that they want you mad at politicians. You understand that a lot of the global elite writers believe in rule by experts, scientific government, they call it, the managerial system, the managerial class, and thus the more ridiculous politicians appear, the more they believe that over time, people are going to clamor for and call for, yes, let me be ruled by AI. Let me be ruled by international UN bureaucracy. Let me be ruled by unelected elites. Because elections and these kinds of things, they just don't work, you see. That's where they want to go. That's the end goal. So here we are where we still have the elections, or at least the appearance of elections. At least local elections are a lot more, I guess, viable than the presidential election at this point. And so how do we get, if we're one of the global elite, how we don't think about it in their mindset, how do we get from here to there? Well, one thing that we would want to do is get people distrusting, disliking the existing system, which at least to in terms of its public structure, runs on the basis of elected officials. Now, we know that the shadow government has had a big hand for, according to Dr. Carol Quigley, a century in selecting and influencing those big elections on a national scale. And increasingly, the global elite have been influencing local elections, especially in key areas in a lot of ways, and not just elected officials, but also judges too, right? So this affects all the branches. And so this is a gradual, slow takeover from shadowy elite groups, which are in themselves really run by Fortune 100, Fortune 500, the top richest families in the world. They run through entities like the Bank for National Settlements, which is sort of the central bank of central banks. They're connected together with all the biggest private foundations, NGOs, think tanks. They're all working towards the exact same goal that I'm telling you. And all of the books say this. That's why this is so crucial to look at their writings, their white papers, and their techniques and tactics. And what we see in the SPARS document and the Lockstep document is they're always a few steps ahead because they're planning for the failure because they want the existing system to collapse. Now, it may not be overnight. It may not be an economic collapse tomorrow. It may not be a EMP tag tomorrow. It may not be a cyber polygon tomorrow. But we might see staggering versions of these things in the next 10 years, again, getting us to the goals of 2030, 2040, and 2050. Those are key decades key periods where they want to have certain things complete in their long-term game plan up to 2050. 2050 is slated to be the full-on total AI depop global government. That's the year they've chosen in many, many documents. There might be a little variation, but basically by 2050 is the goal to have the full-on Brave New World technocratic nightmare in, Terminator Skynet system in place. So here we are, you know, a few decades out from that. What are the things we're going to see in the next few decades? The transition that the elite have planned, the global technocrats have planned to move us away from the previous system into the new system, which is ruled by experts, scientific government, supposedly. It's not actually scientific. It's just complete oligarchy and control, but it's given the title scientific governance. Now, what's the deal here? Why do they want to do this? Well, on the one hand, it's kind of true that politicians are ridiculous, right? I mean, not all of them, but for the most part, kind of everybody senses that there's just something off with the fake two-party system and the idea of, well, you only get these two options and everything is boiled down to basically an oversimplified choice of some person, you know, hundreds of miles away, 1,000 miles away in D.C. that you don't know anything about other than the slogans that you've heard them say on the TV. And everybody knows that they're, you know, sort of bound to corrupt interests and to private interests and whatnot. And so I think everybody kind of senses that there's something broken with the existing system. I'm not saying every politician is corrupt or bad, but on the whole, we kind of think that there's something just kind of goofy about this. It doesn't really make sense. So the legitimate criticism that one might have of the problems in the existing system is precisely what the elite are exploiting. That's the point I'm trying to make here, right? They're trying to say, look at all these problems in the politicians. Look at all the problems in the existing system. Look at how your money's collapsing. It's inflated, which, by the way, is their own plan. They were the ones that planned for this fiat system, getting us away from sound currency and so forth, sound money. That's all by design. And then they blame everybody for their plans. We saw this, for example, in Bertrand Russell and many of the other writings of the elite, that they would blame humankind for the invention of atomic bomb, nuclear bomb, and then say that, well, in order to save humanity for the evil inventions, we're going to have to institute a world government to police all this. And then turn around and say, we, the elite, invented the nuclear bombs because we're smarter than everybody. I mean, literally constant doublespeak, constant lies, constant deception. But again, remember, the goal here is not to help you, not to lead you into a utopia, not to give you a fair system. It is to get rid of you and to put in place a system of complete 100% total technocratic control. And eventually it would be not run by humans, but by computers, a complete AI system running supposedly on perfect math and logic. Then it could bypass human weaknesses, human emotionalism, human flaws. That's the idea, right, of technocracy. Now, I think it's kind of crazy. It's something more akin to a cult, not a cult, but a cult, a belief in the idea that you can have a perfect system run by computers. It's kind of ridiculous. But that's what these people do put their hope and faith in. So what are the signs then that we're under siege being moved into this kind of a system? Again, to put us under a managerial class of rule by experts that is always contrasted against and will be, especially in the coming years, contrasted against the folly of the corrupt politician. Look at Biden. Look at all the scandals. Look at this. They're so silly. They're so goofy. Don't we need rational governance? Don't we need computer governance that's not subject to the flaws and scandals of some goofy politician, some ridiculous boomer who can't even figure out how to use the bathroom, right? I mean, doesn't that sound kind of reasonable? That's what it's playing on. Look at how Fauci failed us. Look at the failures of government. But the reality is that they want to bring in a more heavy-handed governance. Think about Batman Dark Knight as an example. If you remember, in the plot, you have the character Bane, who is sort of this revolutionary, right? He comes from the Far East, and he pops up as this mysterious figure in the underworld. And he engages in all these actions of, well, terror, basically, throughout Gotham. He collapses Gotham's, you know, stock market, and he does all these, you know, revolutionary terror events. And he talks about all the corruption in Gotham. And he's right. Right. I mean, there's a lot of corruption. There's crime. And he's actually working with this and doing more organized crime and chaos to bring about the collapse of the existing Gotham system. Because in his mind, it's all justified because I was born in adversity, right? He was born in adversity. He was born in the flames of, you know, struggle and darkness. And so for him, it's justified to bring in this better system. But what happens when Bane comes to power? Do you guys remember in the plot? Well, it's an even worse system, and it mimics the French Revolution, right? There's guillotines, and you have, Sandman, Cillian Murphy's up there sitting up top this pyramid where he's judging everybody and off with their heads. And it's very reminiscent again of the French Revolution. He's sort of a Robespierre kind of figure. And it becomes a total chaos. So it's even worse. The system that Bane brings in, the revolutionary system, is even worse than the already existing Gotham, you know, elite structure, which I guess you could say Bruce Wayne represents, sort of the billionaire oligarch character, right? Versus this revolutionary anarcho-communist system that Bane wants to bring in, and it's even worse. And it's even more corrupt. You know, everything just falls apart. So the reason, again, that the elite love revolutionary movements and they love the kind of radicalism that we're seeing pushed everywhere is because it's a wrecking ball. It's there to destroy the existing system. And the liberal revolutionaries, these kinds of people, they're just the dupes who are the tools of the system that think that they're going to profit from it. They're going to be in power. They're going to get goodies out of all this. It's going to be, you know, they're going to be the ones that are the true heroes and this kind of stuff. And they're the ones that, of course, always go out first because the revolution isn't run and isn't based on what they think it is. It's actually run by rival oligarchs and rival elites. Likewise, the system wants us to be furious at the notion of a nation state. The nation state's the failure. The existing healthcare system is a failure. It's got to be replaced. And all of the movements that we're seeing are about that. The family is an oppressive structure. The family is a patriarchal structure that is oppressive, and it rapes women, and it, you know, all of this nonsense. And that is just totally a cover, 100%, for depopulation. To make sure that you don't reproduce. That's it. That's the only purpose of that. There's no other purpose than that. So the movement and attack on biological gender, the attack on men and women at the same time, it's a two-pronged attack, right? They want you to either be this crazy purple-haired feminist social justice warrior or this freak incel guy who, you know, hates women. That's a two-pronged social engineering, 100% engineered attack. So the removal of the family is key, and that's what all the global elites say. Get rid of the family because the family is a firewall. It's a kind of progenitor of a tradition, of a heritage. And just like nation states are bad, so little bitty nation states, a.k.a. families, are bad. Right? Think about the nation. Think about the state that you live in, or the U.S. and the states. Then smaller, you get your city. Then smaller, you get your family. All of these are firewalls. They're kind of like walls, concentric circles inside your city protecting you from something bigger. And so to understand that we're under siege, you have to understand that the culture is all geared towards destroying all of that, just wrecking ball, mowing down the whole thing. Every area of society will be overhauled and changed. And the easiest way to do that is not to logically debate with people to try to convince them of globalism, not to do this, but to actually just let the forces of chaos, controlled chaos, erupt and destroy the system from within with the promotion of the elites who want to bring it in, promote the radical causes, because it destroys the existing order to bring in the new order. Don't go anywhere. This is the Alex Jones Show. I'm J. Dyer of J's Analysis. Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, J. Dyer of J's Analysis. We're looking at the 10 signs that we are under siege and that the siege is intended to collapse the country, the West, by design, to bring us into the new system that the elites have planned, particularly the technocratic elites. So we talked first about the attack on humankind themselves in the sense of gender, family. I want to add to that. Number two would be the attack on tradition, the attack on religion, the attack on people maintaining their own heritage and passing that on through a family. A family is just a little bitty sort of transmitter of a tradition, right? It's a little society that then transmits these traditions.
Thank you for listening, and we're going to be playing this on our front page. So go to our front page to hear the total pronouncements that Jay Dyer made on this last Friday. Thank you.